Welcome to Between the Markets on CHRW 94.9 FM. I'm Michelle Boyce.
I'm Adrian Birchtold.
And Adrian is here co-hosting the show. First time on the block for our faithful listeners. You heard her on the Slutwalk show doing an amazing job. And we've asked her to come and talk about today and host the show today. And, you know, we've got a doozy for you today. We've got we're dealing with the Occupy movement, both the occupiers that are here in London and the worldwide occupation movement that is working to rewrite democracy as we know it. So just to get us into the spirit of this, we're going to play a clip for you in just a second because I didn't actually put it up. Bad me. On the system. So we'll have it for you here in a second. But the Occupy movement here in London is going strong and running into some roadblocks that we'll talk about in a minute, but here's that clip for you now.
Hey, thanks, you're no good, the people need a Robin Hood. Hey, thanks, you're no good, the people need a Robin Hood.
We are fighting to save our homes, our jobs, our health care, our pensions, and struggling to keep our foothold in the middle class and get into the middle class.
Inside team representing National People's Action. We went in. We eventually had the opportunity to ask questions. We asked them, how could they sleep at night? Mr. Hyde, the CEO of Wells Fargo, got so nervous his hands began to shake.
We also need our elected officials to close those corporate tax loopholes in offshore havens and institute a financial transaction tax on Wall Street. Yeah. All corporations need to pay their fair share.
Yeah. It's about fairness in the United States of America. I grew up in a different America. And America is not dead. If we work together, the best for our country can be yet to come. Thank you for your patience.
Tell me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Tell me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Tell me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Tell me what democracy looks like.
So that gives you an idea of the Occupy movement. That clip is actually what was called the Robin Hood protest in Chicago by Occupy Chicago. And there is now Occupy movements in every industrialized world or country in the world. They're across Canada in every major city. They're in pretty much every major city across the U.S., Australia, Europe. You look at the Europe map and you can't tell Europe for the dots of Occupy. And, you know, there's a lot of misunderstanding.
Yes, there certainly is. And I think that part of the problem there is that the philosophy behind the movement is that there's no one media spokesperson for each occupation, and so it makes it difficult to get a clear picture in the media of what the occupations are there for and what their messages are and what they're trying to fight for or against.
And typically that's where the public gets their information.
Unfortunately.
Because, I mean, part of the Occupy movement is trying to detach from the corporate media structure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, in one way, it's exactly what they want. And in another, it's really hard to get your message out.
It's really problematic because you need to create, I guess, some kind of recourse, some alternative method of communicating to the public. But even if you do, you have to get the public interested and get the public accessing that those information sources, and so it can be tricky, definitely.
And I think that's some of the growing pains that Occupy mm-hmm. is running across, is that, you know, when you don't have your own spokesman and you don't have someone that can come out and dispel the rumors on media,
mm-hmm.
then it basically gives Fox News, I mean, media, the ability to spin it in any way that they want. And when you don't have a counter story, it's difficult for the movement. So what we're going to try to do today is we're going to try and give you that story. And part of that, there was a teach-in here at the University of Western Ontario last week. And at that teach-in, Steve Darcy gave a presentation which outlined the Occupy movement somewhat in his own words, because that's the way we do it and that's the way we roll. And so this here, listen closely, because this will outline the global Occupy phenomena for you.
First, what kind of movement is the Occupy movement? I want to say personally that I think of it as a global movement. I'm not someone who sees it as having started in Wall Street, at Occupy Wall Street. I think of it as having started in January in Cairo, in Tahrir Square, and having spread from North Africa through Southern Europe in countries like Spain and Greece to Wall Street, and from there spreading to places like London, Ontario, and cities and towns around the world. Currently, there are Occupy encampments in cities and towns on every continent. There is enough commonality and enough solidarity and enough learning from one another that I think we can think of it as one global movement. Secondly, I think it's really important to understand that the movement is a grassroots movement. A lot of social and political movements that go on, whatever their many strengths may be, have one weakness that comes up again and again, which is that they're controlled to one degree or another by organizations such as political parties, trade union organizations, or NGOs and so on. And this often creates a conflict of interest where you have paid staff members of these organizations or politicians who have a particular electoral agenda of getting reelected and so on. And there's a danger, and there's not only a danger but a real problem, that movements get steered towards serving these agendas, or that there's a sort of conflict of interest. This movement is not like that. It is not controlled by anyone except its active participants who come to the General Assemblies and participate in the demonstrations and marches, as well as the encampments and tent cities and so on. The third thing I want to highlight is that it's an anti-capitalist movement. What I mean when I say it's an anti-capitalist movement is that it's a movement the grievances of which cannot really be addressed by capitalism. Capitalism as a system that by its nature puts the maximization of private profits ahead of everything else cannot really accept a political system that's controlled from below by the people. It can't really accept an economic system that puts the needs of people ahead of profits. And it cannot accept a decommodification or distribution according to need instead of profit of things like housing and what have you. And as a result, demands and the grievances that are grievances or concerns that are motivating the movement, or many in the movement, can't really be addressed by capitalism, but in a sense put the movement on a sort of collision course with capitalism, whether or not people are consciously or explicitly thinking of it that way. The fourth thing I want to say is that it is an anti-colonial movement. When the movement was founded, as I would say, in Cairo, in Egypt, one of the key grievances against Hosni Mubarak, the dictator of Egypt, was that he was colluding with U.S. government, the European Union, and the government of Israel to maintain the status quo in Gaza, which has shared a border with Egypt. And this type of anti-colonial sensibility or sense of solidarity against colonialism is something that was there from the beginning of the movement, hasn't always been as prominent or central, arguably, in North America as it may have been initially. But I think, in my opinion, that's increasingly changing, and more and more the issue is being taken up. There are indigenous popular organizations that are involved in Occupy Wall Street and in Occupy movements in other cities. In many cities, the Occupy encampments and General Assemblies are issuing statements of solidarity with indigenous people and so on. So that's an ongoing project, is developing that aspect of the movement, but I think it's always been important and will continue to be. It's also a movement against all forms of injustice, exploitation, and oppression. Important to know that there's feminist organizing going on within the Occupy movement, anti-racist organizing, pro-union organizing, and so on, organizing for trans people's rights and so forth. So the second topic I want to take up is, I'm calling the ingredients of the Occupy model of protest. And I think that the reason I put it that way is that I do believe that it is a generalizable model. So it's something that was created in Tahrir Square in Egypt, but it was quickly found that it could be transferred to other places with where people had other grievances and other concerns, but could build a popular movement using the same model and taking up some of the same issues, but also some new issues. And I think there's three basic elements to the. First is the most visible and I suppose the most obvious feature of the movement is the protest encampments, the occupation of physical space by these protest encampments, or tent cities as some people call them. In part, this is a symbolic gesture of refusal or rejection. In the way it's put by the Occupy Wall Street General Assembly is, the one thing we all have in common is that we will no longer tolerate the greed and corruption of the 1%. So this idea of no longer putting up with or refusing to tolerate the economic and political domination of society by the 1% is symbolized or symbolically expressed by this act of sort of reclaiming the public space. But it also serves as a focus of people's energy and drawing people together in public and sustaining momentum between some of the other particular actions that go on as part of the movement. The second element of the model is radically democratic, participatory democratic general assemblies. In every city where the Occupy movement operates, starting with Cairo and continuing through Wall Street, New York City and in London, Ontario, and everywhere else, the encampments are not only places where people live, but also places where people come together in public forums and deliberate and decide things democratically on a participatory democratic basis. So in Tahrir Square, they had their particular way of doing that, of smaller groups meeting and then sending proposals that were then brought before the whole group, and people would be able to vote for or against these proposals and so on. So Tahrir Square had its particular way of doing that. In the Occupy Wall Street and many of the encampments created in recent weeks, there's a form of consensus decision making. Crucially, these general assemblies have this common character that rather than being based on representative democracy of politicians, the democracy of the 1%, it is based on the participatory democracy of grassroots active participation from below by anyone who supports the movement or wants to join in the activity. So the general assemblies not only have a pragmatic or practical function of organizing life in the encampments, but also have the important political function of embodying, prefiguring, as some might say, a better, deeper, more richer form of democratic participation and decision-making than the one that has been so discredited in recent years, the democracy of the 1%. So that's the second. So we have the encampments and the general assemblies, but a third element that I think is just as important but doesn't get quite as much attention sometimes is the commitment, starting in the camps, the encampments, but also drawing in people from the wider community, the commitment to direct action in support of local struggles. So this is something that's, I think, really crucial to the movement, to building alliances with other people who don't live in the camps, for example, but to educating both the participants in the movement and the wider society about these other struggles that are going on locally, and just building stronger, more powerful popular movements and struggles. So I think it's really crucial as a solidarity builder and as a way of empowering people. This aspect of the movement of direct action in support of local struggles takes the form often of marches, public marches and demonstrations or rallies, form sometimes in some cities of visiting and walking on picket lines for local strikes that are going on, and take the form of civil disobedience actions that take place In every city there are examples, including here in London, where we had a march in support of the right of public protest when the mayor of the 1%, Joe Fontana, threatened to use force to remove protesters from the park here in London, contrary to their moral and constitutional rights. In my opinion, those are the three main ingredients of the model that it gets generalized from city to city, from country to country. Starting, all of those three elements were there in Egypt in January and its ongoing revolution. And all of them are in Occupy Wall Street or Occupy London, Ontario, and so on. So the third topic I want to take up is, why is the movement so important? The first thing that I think is important about the Occupy movement is the way it has created a kind of, or engaged in a kind of pluralistic reinvention of class politics. And what I mean by that is the idea of class struggle or class politics that has been part of left-wing and anti-capitalist, anti-corporate politics for 150 years or more has always played a big role in sort of left-wing politics. But for many decades, it was marred or undermined in a sense by the fact that the way in which the notion of the worker or the working class was understood bore very little relation to reality. So even in Marx's own time, you know, most working class people, most factory workers actually, were women and children. And yet, over the years and the decades, the picture of what the worker is or the working class is where this sort of image of the typical worker, of a white male industrial factory worker, arose as if it were indeed typical of working class people, or as if it was a sufficient way of imagining or understanding the working class. But that has been completely discarded and replaced by the Occupy movement with a completely different and far more pluralistic and yet equally solidarist way of understanding class solidarity and class consciousness. One of the most striking and prominent ways in which this new pluralistic understanding of class solidarity is developing within the Occupy movement, there's a website that's called wearethe99%.tumblr.com. So on that website, people post pictures of themselves holding up handwritten notes. And what they do is people talk about their own economic and personal and political struggles as individual human beings, struggling to get by, all sorts of difficulties and challenges and forms of inequality and oppression that are harming them and that they want to fight back against. And that people always end by saying, I am the 99%. Meaning, I as an individual human being with my individual life story am part of a larger movement and in solidarity with other people who also have their own individual stories. And I think they want to hear my story and I want to hear their story. So it's a kind of solidarity founded not upon an imaginary sameness or identifying with this sort of imaginary figure of the typical worker, but rather on giving people the opportunity to talk about their own struggles and challenges and their own barriers and burdens that they want to fight back alongside other people against. So I think that's a kind of new understanding of class struggle, the 99% against the 1%, that is, I think, very important for the future of anti-capitalist politics. The second thing that I want to highlight in terms of the importance of the movement is the way in which it is reinventing democracy in an inclusive, or aspiring to and trying to reinvent democracy in a participatory and inclusive way. The background to this, I think, is the discrediting of official democracy. Just recently, in October, mid-October, there was a poll in the United States that showed that only 13% of Americans approve of the U.S. Congress, which is supposedly includes the House of Representatives, which is supposed to be the representatives of the people. But only 13% of Americans feel represented by the U.S. Congress. And less than half approve of the president as well. So people do not feel, that's the United States, but I think this is a pervasive global phenomenon of the discrediting of politicians, the discrediting of official politics. In many ways, the mood of the people globally to want to challenge that and to want not to get rid of democracy, of course, but to build a new democracy. And I feel that the Occupy movement is serving as a vehicle for people to actively participate in reinventing democracy, not representative democracy where they elect a politician, but participatory democracy where they become a participant in the decision-making process actively and directly. Not a democracy which serves as a kind of mask concealing the dominance and the rule of the 1%, but democracy where people take charge of their own lives and communities from below. So this reinvention of democracy, I think, is a crucial sort of public service, if I can put it that way, that the movement is performing. Again, globally, it's happening in some ways, in more dramatic ways, in places like Egypt and Greece and Spain, but it's happening everywhere, including right here in London and Syria. And the last one is, I think that the Occupy movement, to the extent that it is a movement that is based on this refusal to tolerate the domination of society by the 1%, and the demand for a new democracy of the 99%, I feel that it's implicitly a movement that has to pose the question, and is already starting to pose the question in many ways, of economic democracy, of extending, not only deepening democracy with respect to political life, but extending democracy into economic life, into the workplace, into decisions about the type of economy we want to have, the way in which we do or do not invest as a society in alternative energy and so forth. These kinds of questions, which are now seen as private questions for consumers or corporations to make, are being raised implicitly and or explicitly by the Occupy movement as public questions that we should address collectively in common as part of our attempts to take control of our own lives and communities back from the 1%. So these three things, that the reinvention of class politics, the reinvention of democracy by the sort of radicalization of it, and the extension of democracy into economics, aren't necessarily things that the movement has already done, but things that the movement is in the course of doing, and they represent the kind of the hope or the prospects for the movement, in my view, and why, to me, it's an especially important movement.
And thanks a lot, Steve Darcy, for giving us that excellent overview of the Occupy movement. And that was, we were both there at the teach-in.
Yeah, we were.
And it was very well taken. Occupiers were there, as well as people looking to learn.
And people perhaps looking to start an Occupy Western, which is very exciting.
Very exciting.
We'll see. I don't know if it's going to happen for sure, but people
we'll
are interested. So
yeah. So we'll see if that comes to be. And, you know, with all of the oppressive behavior that happens around Western, it'd definitely be an excellent thing, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we'll see how Occupy London goes over the next little while. So as you see from what Steve was saying there, Occupy is a movement that is working on rewriting everything that we know about democracy. And anybody that thinks that can be done in 2 weeks...
it's going to take a lot longer than that.
Yeah, is not understanding the movement. And I think that's where people that are trying to boot occupiers out are missing the point. And the point is that people that typically are not engaged in politics are engaged in the Occupy movement.
And they're having their voices heard. And so even if they perhaps have tried to be engaged in the past, this is the first time that they're really getting a true opportunity to have their concerns addressed. And there's been a lot of talk about sort of issues within the occupations, whatever it might be, different forms of oppression, different forms, you know, disagreements on sort of conduct and behavior. But I think the really wonderful thing about the occupation and about these general assemblies and about participatory democracy is that these issues are addressed within the community, and they're tackled head on, and they're tackled by everyone together, essentially.
Yeah, so. And there's no one voice.
Right.
And there's, I mean, the whole process is consensus-based processing,
mm-hmm.
which everybody or almost everybody has to agree on anything. And even one dissenting voice, if it dissents strong enough, can railroad everything.
Definitely. Yeah.
And I mean, people talk about those hand signals.
The twinkling.
The twinkling, you know, up twinkling, which, you know, this is radio, so it's hard to get the visual.
Imagine jazz hands facing upwards.
You stick your fingers straight up in the air and wiggle them. Okay, so that means you like something.
Straight out in front of you and wiggling means you are kind of on the fence. You're not sure, but you'll let it slide. kind of thing.
And then you've got down twinkling, where your fingers point straight down and twinkle, and that says no way. I'm in disagreement.
Yeah.
I'm in disagreement with this, and I'm not liking what's being said. So, I mean, there's a lot of people that make fun of this process out there.
It can look kind of silly, I guess, but the fact is that it is an opportunity for folks involved in the discussion, in the dialogue, in the GAs, to express dissent or express agreement without having to interrupt the person who's speaking, without having to sort of put more negative energy into the discussion by, I don't know, yelling or booing or trying to cut someone off to voice their own opinion. And
it's a much more civilized way to have a conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, it works rather well. And I mean, when I'm doing public speaking, I would love it if, rather than trying to read the emotions of the crowd, you know, they can just tell me, hey, Michelle, you're way off base here. You know, get back on point. And, you know, that would be great as a public speaker instead of having to guess your way through.
Right.
But in radio, I don't get to see it either.
I mean, it can be a bit of a frustrating process because it takes longer. People aren't used to having to put in the time to have this sort of participation in their own government, in their democracy. And I think that really is a symptom of more systemic problems within our society and the expectations that are placed on us and the lack of priority that we're expected to give government and to give our own participation in that government. You know, we're expected to just vote every 4 years and that's it.
Yeah.
Which is not enough.
It's not enough, exactly. And I mean, this goes back to First Peoples elder councils, you know, where you'd get a bunch of elders in a room and they'd try to make a decision. And each elder would use an I statement and they would describe how they see whatever scenario is happening. Mm-hmm. And then it would move on to the next elder and they would say how they feel and how they see it, and around it would go until the I statements started coming together as a consensus. No one ever pointed their finger across that circle and said, you should think. You know, that was not the process.
Right.
The process was around and around the conversation went until you had consensus. Now, that takes a long time.
Yeah.
But it's a very healthy way of making decisions.
And I feel in the end that it's more productive. You're reaching decisions that are not as likely to lead to problems in the future, to lead to protest in the future. You know, you're getting all of the opinions out there, all the demands and desires out there from the beginning, and so you can address them all before taking steps, taking action.
Yeah, and I mean, another thing that occupiers have in their arsenal, because they don't have amplification, is the people's mic.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something else that really sounds strange to people that aren't familiar with the Occupy movement. And so I'm just going to give you an example of what a people's mic and people amplification sounds like.
Mic check!
Mic check!
We amplify each other's voices.
We amplify each other's voices.
No matter what's said.
No matter what's said.
So we can hear one another.
So we can hear one another.
So that is something that sounds really strange to people.
Definitely. And it can be distracting and it can be just new. I mean, just difficult to get used to, but it really encourages people to be completely actively participating in the discussion, I feel. Like, when I've experienced it, really forces me to pay attention to what's being said because I have to repeat it afterwards. So, you know, I know I'm constantly up to date with what's happening in the dialogue. It's I don't get distracted. I'm there 100% all the time.
It's really hard to be on your BlackBerry texting somebody when you have to pay attention. So, I mean, that's the good side. I mean, some of the complaints about the bad side is that words come out of your mouth that you may not agree with.
Right, and that's something that can be perhaps addressed. I know that there have been some concerns about, you know, people feeling like their voices are being appropriated by having to voice opinions they disagree with. But I don't feel... I mean, maybe it's not necessary for all the GAs. Like, they started it using it in Wall Street because they literally were not allowed to use a megaphone. They were not allowed to use any type of machinery that would amplify their voice. So they had to do something else.
Exactly. So we're going to be back with more about this story after the commercial break. Yeah, back after these messages.
We are all in this together.
Between the Margins, a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after. I'm Michelle Boyce.
I'm Adrian Birchtold.
And we're talking about the Occupy movement. You know, we've been talking about the world as we know it and how it's, you know, the Occupy movement is looking to change things. And I mean, one of Canadians that have been working really, really hard at changing things and standing up is Bridget DePape, who this girl is the girl that stood up in the Senate with the Stop Harper sign and got booted out for her protest action. And I think it's fitting to hear her side of the story on Occupy.
What is so amazing about the Occupy movement is that we are the 99%. And what does that mean? That nobody gets left behind. We will not accept one person going hungry, one person being jobless, one person being homeless. We are the 99%. And we are going to put a stop to the 1% of corporate greed. A few months ago, I held up a sign in the Senate to stop Harper. We see his destructive agenda. It is destructive for people in Canada, for Indigenous peoples, for workers, for students, for women, for everyone. I made one small action that got a lot of attention, but we see people coming together every day to stop Harper and stop corporate greed. After the action in the Senate, the mainstream media tried to belittle me, and they are trying to belittle the Occupy mobilizations. I read an article in the National Post today saying, comparing the numbers that are showing for mobilizations to an Italian wedding. My response to that, this is a tremendous marriage of outrage and of action. And why are they trying to belittle us? Because they're scared. Because we are no longer expressing our concerns on Facebook, on Twitter, in the privacy of our small friendship groups. We are getting mobilized.
And mobilized Occupy is getting.
Certainly is.
Across the world, around everywhere. So, I mean, the Occupy movement around the world has a single message and then a multitude of messages. Yeah, I mean, we have the riot call. Mm-hmm. You know, we are the 99%.
Mm-hmm. I think what's really important about that, too, is particularly in Canada, you know, this idea of income inequality has been named sort of the gap between the rich and the poor for quite a long time. And the problem with that is that the majority of Canadians identify as middle class, and they don't identify as rich or as poor. And this statement, we are the 99%, and this invitation to the middle class, really, to get involved and to get angry and to start fighting against the income inequality that they experience as well is unique, I think.
Absolutely. And it's unique to this generation.
Mm-hmm.
Up until the 70s, we borrowed our money as a government from ourselves. And then, you know, in the 70s, in Trudeau years, the bankers said, hey, that's not your job. You should be borrowing this from us.
Right.
And for some crazy reason,
we said, oh, okay.
We said, okay. You know, I don't know about anybody out there in my listening audience, but, you know, if I've got a money tree in the backyard and I can just pick my own money, I'm not going to go and get a bank loan.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but and that's what the Bank of Canada is there for. It's to print money for the use within the population, and we can do that all we want without paying interest. So for some strange, bizarre reason, in the Trudeau days, with Chrétien as finance minister, it was decided that, no, we should do it a different way. And I think that's what Occupy is getting back to, mm-hmm. is we need to do the way that that was convinced isn't working.
Yeah, I think that really highlights one of the main concerns of that spans really, I would say, all the Occupy movements is this influence that corporate money has over politics, over our economy, and how the government organizes our budgets and our national economies. Is the people are not having their say anymore.
Exactly. And we went down to Occupy London and talked to a few folks there. And we have some tape from that now from Derek Stevens, who tells us his story and why he's at Occupy London.
I'm Derek Stevens.
Okay.
Been a resident of London my whole life.
Awesome.
And I stand for all aspects of political human rights activism, and I'm pro-life. I see this kind of conflict, this clash, as almost a matter versus spirit or a money versus health issue, where we're a people divided by people who value money and material things more than life, and a people who value health and life and living things more than the material. And if you think about it, historically, we've all types of civilization have been about putting control and power over the many in the hands of the few. Since the Roman Empire, since the British Empire, since the Chinese Empire, since the slaves in Africa, and since the colonization and extermination of the natives here on our homeland. So I think that what we need to do is just realize our history, realize the truth about the system we've been born into, and start to change things by the people, for the people. This change can only happen through one way, and that is love for each other.
And Derek brings up the First Peoples issue.
Mm-hmm. Which is something that I think is getting addressed more and more through the various Occupy movements. However, I think it needs to be focused on more, particularly in London. I think that they're working on it, but I haven't seen as much collaboration as I think is necessary. There are a lot of parallels between the struggles that sort of the occupiers are facing and the 99% in general are facing and those that were faced, you know, many, many years ago by First Nations. And we have to recognize that we non-First Nations people have privilege. We have to recognize that privilege and look to those who have been through these struggles before for guidance and advice on how to bring our struggle forward. And
absolutely. And I mean, the Occupy's values go back to First People values.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to engage in seeking out those communities for advice, because they have centuries of experience with exactly the same thing that the
Absolutely.
Occupy movement is up against. And, you know, that experience is extremely valuable to this. So let's hear from Eric Shepherd about Occupy London.
My name is Eric Shepherd.
Wonderful. And tell me your story.
Well, I've been watching the world the last few years, and things are not going well. There is, of course, many inspiring things going on, but, of course, there is also lots of trouble in the world. We're seeing income inequality at the greatest amount that it's been in many, many years. Social inequity is reigning as status quo right now, and our environmental resources are being systematically squandered, and that's not good. Something's got to change about that. So as I started to see these revolutions start this spring with the Arab Spring, I started to become excited about the prospect of a worldwide revolution starting. Things started to amplify throughout the summer, and now suddenly I saw Occupy Wall Street start about a month and a half ago now. As things started to progress and spread throughout North America, it came to Toronto 2 weekends ago. So I was there in Toronto, and I saw the occupation begin there, and it was truly awe-inspiring. It was like nothing I had never seen before. People of various different viewpoints and ideas and different types of people coming together, sharing in respect and support of each other, their ideas and their viewpoints, and solving problems, working on problems that the world has right now. So on the bus back home, we decided as a group, we're going to do this. We're going to do this right here. And so 2 weekends ago, we set up camp here, and we've been here ever since.
And what are you locally? We know the Occupy movement worldwide, but what locally are you trying to accomplish?
Well, here we're trying to establish a mutually supportive and respectful community, somewhere where people can come together as individuals, share themselves, and work out these local problems. We have problems here in the city with poverty, with homelessness, mental illness, all sorts of other things, and the issues keep coming. Every person who comes in here brings up another point that they would like to address, and they address it with the support of others.
So, in London, I hate to bring up the the controversies and everything else, but the city seems to be slowly changing their tune towards Occupy. What are your feelings about that?
Well, we feel that our charter right to public assembly applies 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all the time. A local ordinance, however, applies in this park between the hours of 10 o'clock at night and 6 o'clock in the morning, where we can't be here at that time. Now, I feel that our charter rights supersede a local ordinance, because we do have that globally across the country, that charter right. So, in terms of the city's opinion towards us, they don't have a leg to stand on, because we have the right to be here. And these tents, these structures that we've erected, supposedly illegally, contravening the bylaw, they are part of our right to free assembly, because it is necessary. It is cold out here. It is windy. We need tents. We need to be able to be in a comfortable place to do the work that we're doing here.
And what do you say to the people that say you're wasting your time?
I don't agree. We are definitely not wasting our time here, because we are making progress. Already we are feeding and clothing and housing the homeless, the hungry, and as well, we're building a community that you do not see in the general real life, so to speak. This kind of a bond between people is very seldom in this world. And the people that I've just met 2 weeks ago, I feel closer to them than many people that I've known for years and years and years. In terms of what we're actually accomplishing here, we've already made good progress on some ideas that we can take to our city council around homelessness, around poverty, that should be given their due course. They should be considered as seriously as with the suggestion that we provide. we have a lot of work to do. There are many problems that we need to address, and we need to have that time. This is not a one-week, two-week process. This is the beginning. This is phase one. This is where we begin to start to make the change that we want to see, and every step of the way, we need to be here for that.
So the other side of the coin is, how do people get involved?
You can get involved in many different ways. The best thing that you can do is come down and see what we're doing here. Because a lot of the criticism is based on conjecture, based on that which you haven't seen, you don't know what's going on here. You need to come and see this. You need to see what we're accomplishing here, what we're doing here. The other thing is that you can start to have conversations. You can discuss with your friends and family about the issues that we're facing and come to some sort of agreement about what you care about, what you think we should be thinking about. The other thing is, we of course always need material goods. That is unfortunately a necessary truth. There is always need for food, for warm clothing, for tarps, for other things of that nature. And of course, just to show your support. To publicly say to other people, I support these occupiers. I support what they're talking about, what they're doing, and invite other people to come down.
And your message to Brad Duncan and Joe Fontana?
I would say that they should come down here too. We have repeatedly invited all city councillors and the mayor to come down, visit us, see what we're doing, and listen to us, and as well, contribute to our conversation. They have as much a right to be here as we do, and we would like to hear their voices.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
So that takes us back to London. And the struggles. And the struggles with city council. And and the fact that they're occupying public space. And as we heard earlier from Steve, occupying public space is part of the Occupy movement.
It's kind of wouldn't really have the same weight or message, I feel, if they moved over to the part or to the church that they've been given permission to occupy. It's this signal of refusal is, I mean, it spans just it goes beyond just the refusal to obey a certain bylaw. It's a refusal of an entire system that is not working.
Yeah, and if they moved over to where they've been given permission to be, that kind of defeats the purpose, because the Occupy movement is basically saying, you have failed. You have failed us. We no longer recognize your right to govern us.
Mm-hmm. We're going to do it differently.
We're going to do it differently. We're going to do it a different way. It's going to be bottom-up politics. Nobody knows what that looks like. Nobody knows what it's going to look like. But Occupy needs the time.
Yeah, and it takes patience, but it's certainly a worthwhile endeavor to find out what it will look like.
So Courtney took off and represented Occupy at City Hall in that meeting with City Hall. And here's her opinions on that. I'm here with Courtney Dakin, which is one of the organizers of today's event on the teach-in on Occupy. And you were one of the individuals invited to speak to Mayor Fontana about the occupation movement. Can you tell me generally what your experience was?
Yeah, I was a delegate from the General Assembly, so I was nominated, elected, and then I was giving a completely collective statement, so I tried to really make that be void of any personal opinions. The council's response, very unsurprising. I mean, they're politicians, their words were very shallow, they didn't guarantee that they wouldn't resort to violence and forceful removal of the occupants, which was our main purpose of being there, was defending the need to be on public space, how we're really adding to the park. There's more people there than I've ever seen use Victoria Park this time of year, that we're really offering just an addition to public space, public libraries and gatherings like that, and how it's really important that we thought that we should be using that space. Yeah, they just talked around us to decided that They didn't feel like they could guarantee our safety, which was really troubling to a lot of people because we put a lot of effort into creating a safe space and making it completely inclusive. And we've welcomed police officers into our camp. There's four that hang around now. They have a heavy presence. We've never been rude to them, and we really don't want to provoke them in any way. So you can see that there's really competing interests within that the municipal political sphere, that as much as they like to think that they're representing us, they're obviously representing interests that conflict with us, specifically those of the corporations in London.
What do you think about Victoria Park? I mean, Lighting of the Lights is coming, and the Christmas season is coming, and the skating rink and all that. How does the Occupy movement fit into that season in Victoria Park?
Well, we're very much in solidarity with the Lighting of the Lights that happened last night. And the mayor portrayed it as we were refusing to move, when actually earlier that day, when they gave us warning about the ceremony taking place near a tree where we had the encampment, we completely moved the encampment. And Locke has released statements in solidarity with us. We really didn't mean to be in the way. And to add to that, I think there's been talk of actually a solidarity lighting ceremony tonight to show that we in no way wanted to infringe on the actions of other groups. We completely support the work that Locke's doing, and definitely see that violence against women is a huge issue that is definitely part of this movement addressing it. So.
Wonderful. So how would you like municipal and city hall to change in the city?
I would like them to operate more consensus-based, like our General Assemblies. And I think a big part of this is I actually, as a delegate, invited the councillors to come out and attend a General Assembly. And there have been a few. I know Nancy Branscombe was at the camp and visiting, but actually seeing how our dialogue takes place is, I think, really important, because that's really a void in the councillor meetings right now. It's still one direction, right? Either they're talking to us or each other, or we're talking to them. There's no real fluid exchange, which I think is really important in getting to our common beliefs and common goals, is the fluidity of that exchange. So I would like to see council come out to the park more, specifically attending the General Assemblies, which happen twice a day, one at noon and one at 6 p.m.
Wonderful. Thanks for talking to me.
No problem. Thank you.
So the Occupy movement is kind of threatening to City Hall.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they don't want a government that looks like the municipal government we have right now in London. So if I were in City Hall, I would be feeling pretty threatened myself.
Especially when you haven't, you know, it's not a large encampment on Victoria Park, mm-hmm. but they have the power of the world. And they have the power of the people around the world. And quite frankly, Occupy seems to have more support than the the House of Congress in the States has. So quite frankly, as far as the power of the people and the word of the people, Occupy has the majority.
Mm-hmm.
Which is scary. Because not scary that Occupy has the majority, but that there's that much discontent with our current system that a fledgling organization that's less than a year old has garnished more support than 100 years of democracy has.
Well, I mean, it's inspirational. It's the first time I can say that I'm really seeing a model for what change would look like. And yeah, it's messy. And yeah, as we've said, it's going to take some time to sort of work out the creases. But or work out the kinks, or I don't know, whatever. but I can go to the Victoria Park. Anyone in the city can go to Victoria Park, and they can see and be a part of creating a new model for governing ourselves, and that, you know, it's revolutionary.
It is, and. And, I mean, the city has got to give these people time.
Definitely. And there have been, I mean, I can't speak for the movement, but I, from what I've witnessed and from what I've been a part of, it's very accommodating, you know. They're very fluid in the location of the park they need to occupy or want to occupy. It just, as we've said, it needs to be public space. But if there are certain things that the city needs to do to, you know, maintain the park, I'm sure that the occupiers are not, you know, averse to that.
Absolutely. And the mayor keeps saying, I'm tired of asking permission. Well, quite frankly, Mr. Mayor, I do like you, but that is your job, is to constantly be going out to the electric and asking permission.
Mm-hmm.
So please continue to ask permission, represent the people, and if the people want something different, move out of the way and let it happen.
Or go down and be a part of it.
Absolutely.
I mean, there have been multiple invitations, and Joe Fontana has sort of said, well, you know, you can come to us. We can have meetings. We can have twice a year, you know, open town halls, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But not once has he made the effort to actually come to the park and to find out, you know, why people are really there and what are the issues that need to be addressed and how he can be a part of addressing those, which is, as you said, his job.
His job. And engaging, he seems to engage with everyone else. He engaged with Pride London, which was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
He engaging with various other ethnic groups that haven't been engaged by the city in the past, which is awesome. Here's another group, Mr. Fontana. Engage. We encourage you to engage, and hopefully you'll take that advice. And unfortunately, we're out of time.
Shucks.
Yeah, because, you know, I'm looking down at my sheet at how many other ways we could have gone with this show, and I do encourage people to stop by the Occupy tents. You know, it's really a comfortable place to just sit down and talk to people. It's a really safe and open space, and it's non-threatening, and I...
Cool. Sorry, and to witness the GAs is really something special. So they have them, I think, twice a day, and you can experience the human mic, the hand signals, all the amazing things we've been talking about today.
Absolutely. So this has been our show on Occupy. I'm Michelle Boyce.
I'm Adrienne Birchtold.
And thank you for listening, and have yourself your happily ever after, however that may look like to you.